Hello and welcome to the LRM podcast, sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance. I'm Martin Dominey, and today we're on location at Norfolk Garage with Richard Hall. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Martin.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Excellent. You might have heard in the last podcast, I actually bought an engine off Richard, which is why I'm here, picking up a very nice 12, it's actually an 11, Joe. Ex-military 2.5?
Yeah,
it's one of the ex-military ones that were made for late production runs of the 110s after they'd stopped doing 2.5 NAs.
So it's slightly different. They got two-part turbo D more.
Something I didn't actually know about, but you've also done sort of a package deal, if you like, with a turbo. So it might, in the future, get that bolted on for a little bit of extra power. We'll see how we go.
Yeah.
So off the back of all the problems I had with the injection pump on the 14J, which is the incorrect engine anyway, I thought I'm going to go to someone I know and get a replacement engine complete with pump. So that's exactly what I've done. So thank you very much for that, Richard.
No problem.
This is the second time I've been here. The first time I turned up unannounced and you were flat out with work, and I felt ever so terrible afterwards. I sort of went home and thought, oh, I shouldn't have just turned up.
I felt really guilty because I hadn't offered you a cup of tea or anything, but
no.
We were up against this nightmare deadline. I can't remember what it was, but it was...
I think you had an MOT, but you were saying.
An MOT. I was trying to get a vehicle ready for MOT, and it was throwing one problem after another at us, and
as they do.
Yeah.
We actually got a date in the diary and thought we'd combine picking up said engine with doing a little podcast, because I'm sure loads of people will want to get to know the man behind Norfolk Garage, which has been a staple of LRM for many years.
Yeah, I can't remember when we started doing this. It must have been about 2011 or 12, something like that, when I started writing magazine, did a couple of technical articles, and then we came up with the idea of doing a monthly column.
An excellent column it is. I
very kind.
Always learn something. I've got several bookmarked on Readly for where I know that there's something I will need to know in the future, but you know, I go back to them all the time. Things like the 14J Sherpa engine, the pulleys on the timing belt, things like that. How to bleed the LT77 clutch slave cylinders properly by letting them hang. I've learned loads of tips from you, so I'm sure a lot of readers are on the same page.
Yeah, it's something that I was talking to someone about this the other day, about people will ask you, how do you know that? And you just do it. I'm sorry, it's actually the guy who runs the garage where I do my MOTs. I mean, I hadn't realised he was 80 last week. It was 80th birthday and still... Still standing and doing MOTs when the regular MOT tester is too busy, but hey, we were talking about exactly that, and you just build up experience and over many years, and then you end up just knowing stuff, and even you don't know why you know this stuff. It's just there.
It's like riding a bike after all these years, I should think, Richard. You've actually been in business a lot longer than you've been writing for Land Rover Monthly.
Yeah, I think I started in about... It's hard to remember exactly, about 2001, 2002. I was made redundant from the work I was doing at the time, which I wasn't enjoying anyway. As by notes director of an engineering company, and we'd been taken over by some Americans who were looking to put their people in place. And so I started out just buying Land Rovers off eBay, preparing them, and then selling them off my driveway for less money than I put into them. And after three or four, I got bored with that, and I thought, I'll get a small workshop and then start repairing Land Rovers and see if I could lose some money that way. And sure enough, I lost lots of money repairing Land Rovers, and I've just carried on losing money on Land Rovers ever since. It's never been a terribly lucrative. If you want to get rich, then running a Land Rover repair business as a one-man band is absolutely not the way to do it. You know, it really is. You spend far so much of your time just doing admin stuff and pricing up jobs, answering the phone, ordering parts, and stuff. And you end up, if you're lucky, you might be able to charge 15 hours of your work a week. And to do that, you're probably working 45, 50 hours a week.
Wow.
And most of that is just dead time. It's not actually making you any money.
I have to say, I was surprised when I asked you before we started recording if you had a full-time mechanic, and you said no, it was you doing everything. The admin, like you say, parts ordering, dealing with customers, that must eat into your time hugely. And I can see how it would be a real challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. It used to be more common than it was. I can remember when I first bought a Land Rover back in 1987, 88, then there were loads of people doing what I'm doing now. That's basically the people who inspired me to set up my own business. You know, this one-man van, repairing old Land Rovers out of shed. But that's not so common now for various reasons. I think the overheads have got a lot higher to start with. It's a lot more expensive to run a small business than it used to be.
I was going to say, we also touched on the fact that you've comparatively been quite lucky finding a premises, but as a lot of listeners and readers probably know as well, if they've tried to get a little workshop to work on their own stuff, it's a nightmare trying to get a landlord who will let you work on Land Rover or any vehicle.
Absolutely. There is a prejudice against motor trade among the commercial landlords, and
it's not entirely unfair. It's a dirty, messy business. You, with the best will in the world, you're going to end up with dead cars lying around outside and piles of scrap waiting to be collected, and everything gets covered in oily fingerprints. And these are the good tenants. The bad ones are we'll just do a runner and leave the landlord with about a month clearing up and probably a whole load of hazardous waste dumped out the back.
It does only take a few apples to spoil the barrel, unfortunately, doesn't it? Yeah, like you said, you've been fairly lucky with your last premises and this one. But all good things, unfortunately, must come to an end, as you've hinted to in your column in a recent issue of Land Rover Monthly. So now, but you're not hanging up the tools, are you? You're just moving and changing what you're doing.
What's happened is I've had some ongoing injury problems for a while back and shoulder problems. And it got to about October last year, and I was just coming into winter, and I'd had about 25-mile drive from where I was living at the time on some of the worst roads in England. Really, yeah, kind of roads that have grass growing down the middle of them. And I was doing that in the dark and moving on heavy tubes and painkillers. And I thought, I'm not going to be able to get through to be able to keep doing this much longer. Going into winter, I'm not doing another winter like this. I'd always said that if this job stopped being fun, I'd stop doing it. And last winter, it kind of stopped being fun. But I still love the vehicles. I love working on the vehicles. But I've got to the stage where I think if I were to carry on doing general heavy repair and restoration work, I could easily find myself in a position where I got halfway through doing a major job and found that I hadn't got physical strength to finish it. And I don't want to put myself in that position. So what I'm going to be doing is concentrating on just an engine and gearbox rebuilds on a fairly small scale for the older vehicles. I think there's a gap in the market somewhere between the 1,500 quid eBay specials and on one end and the full of remanufactured or singing, dancing, very expensive, very beautiful engines at the other. Yeah, then that's pretty much what I'm going to be doing.
Right. I was going to say you've started stockpiling series gearboxes already for...
Yeah, I've been acquiring series gearboxes, and I've got a little stash of engines, two and a quarter petrol engines. You used to be able to... You could find them under hedges not too long ago, and now you want a 2.25 petrol. They're really, really hard to find, so I've been sort of hoarding those and components for me. And I've got a couple of TDI engines, and basically I'll be rebuilding engines for customers, and if things go quiet, I'll just pull something out of the pile and rebuild it and then offer it for sale. And because there you do get quite a few people who will, there are quite a few restoration projects out there, which people who will buy, which are missing the engine or missing the gearbox, or they've got the wrong engine gearbox in them. And it's not just a question of bringing your local scrapyard now and being able to come up with a good working engine or box speeds vehicles. The vehicles aren't being broken anymore. And the mechanical bits on them are so old anyway that if you buy an unrebuilt engine off the floor, it might be 50 or 60 years old and never been touched. I had one a few weeks ago that I rebuilt. It was a 1977 Series 3 petrol engine that I'd had sitting around for ages, and someone needed a bottom end for one in a hurry. So I dragged this thing out, stripped it down, and found that it's got original Land Rover pistons, original standard size bearing shells. The thing had never been apart.
Wow.
So everything was fairly worn out as a result. But, you know, there's quite a lot like that that I dismantled and found that actually I'm the first person to be in there since the things left the factory. And that's, you know, 50 or more years old.
Yeah, it's incredible. I think, like you said about the 2.25 petrols, they had no value for so long because everyone was pulling them out and putting TDIs in and things like that and whatever else. And they sort of either had a problem anyway and probably got scrapped or left outside and gone to ruin or, you know, stashed away. Neil Watterson, for instance, has still got the original out of his Series 2A. It's, you know, got the right numbers on it and everything. And he hasn't got rid of it because at some point he will have that rebuilt and then put back in. So he might be giving you a ring at some point.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is interesting the way things have gone. But you've got, we're actually leaning on at the moment, a very, very interesting looking Series 2A, isn't it?
Yes, it's an early 2A. Actually, really early 2A, 1961. It's one of the first ones built. I can't remember the exact chassis number on it, but it's a very low number.
Yeah, so our customers, you were telling me, and it's sort of in for make it really, really nice mechanically. He's not as fussed about the cosmetics, but it's I can paint the picture for the listener. It's got a new Robert Owen bulkhead. It's got a non-turbo or D-turbo TDI.
Turbo TDI engine.
Which is quite popular from what you...
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't claim credit for having come up with the idea, but
this was back in, I think, guess about 2004, 2005. I bought a Series 3 with a very rattly engine. I bought it from Hertfordshire and drove it home, but it wasn't entirely happy. It was £700 for a really tidy little Series 3, which is gives you a kind of idea of how much of things have gone up in value. It was nice, we needed an engine, and I picked up, at the time, 200 TDIs. Discoveries weren't yet being scrapped in huge numbers, and 200 TDI engines were actually not especially easy to get hold of, and they were relatively expensive. I bought one suspiciously cheaply, had it delivered, and it turned out the turbo on it was short.
Right.
It was absolutely, yeah, it did huge amount playing the variance. And I was looking at this and I was thinking, just as an experiment, just as a temporary measure, let's see whether the thing will run without the turbo, because it's you take the turbo off it and you've got a 2.5 litre direct injection diesel, very similar to the old Ford Transit engine in terms of general dimensions. And I thought that if the fueling isn't too far out, and it shouldn't be, you know, running without the boost line connected, obviously I thought there was a chance that it might actually work. So I cobbled this thing together, put it in, and found it actually worked quite nicely. And I drove the thing around. I used that as my daily transport for a couple of years, and I've done a few since for customers. And I put some information on the internet telling other people how to do it. And it's one of those things. Some people will say, what's the point in taking the turbo off it? And it's not supposed to be an either with turbo or without turbo. It's not an alternative to a 200 TDI with turbo. 200 TDI in a series vehicle with the full fat turbo installation is a huge amount of fun. They're actually quite quick and very entertaining. This is, but there's a lot more plumbing involved. This is a very simple drop in. You can use the standard exhaust system. You can use the standard radiator.
Wow.
Very, very little work in gold. And it's an alternative, I guess, it's a good swap for a 2.25 petrol if you're looking for similar performance, better fuel economy. It's a big improvement on a 2.25 diesel.
Not that that's particularly difficult to achieve.
The one I had back then had overdrive on it. You know, it cruised quite happily, 65 all day. I had a big eye for Williams Beaver Tail trailer, 3.5-ton trailer, and I was using this vehicle to tow 109s and 110s on that trailer.
Wow.
And it would take a while to get up to speed, but it would hold 55 quite happily with that kind of load on the back of there. That actually worked quite well. Yeah, main downside of it is they are, for some reason, they are a lot noisier than a turbo-equipped one.
Oh, right.
It's surprising how much exhaust noise that turbo and intake noise that turbo takes out.
Right.
And they really are quite rackety.
I was going
to
say, I've
put in a bit of soundproofing to make them.
So what manifolds do they take?
You've got the 200 TDI, the standard Discovery TDI inlet manifold.
Right.
It's got a slightly restrictive intake on it. You just lop that off with an angle grinder and that gives you a larger air intake. And the exhaust manifold is slightly modified. Well, I was using 3-bolt, 2.25 diesel 3-bolt downward facing exhaust manifolds. They look really, really hard to find. And then I discovered that the early 2.5 NA manifolds, which were a lot easier to find, are basically the same except for the downpipe stud size and pattern.
Oh, right.
So you, or spacing. So basically, you bolt one of those to it. You take the standard 2¼ downpipe, enlarge the three holes in the flat mounting flange into slots, whiten up it an M10 stud, and then just fit it with flange bolts.
Wow,
flange nuts,
and it works really well. Yeah, injection pump. You said just blank off the turbo.
You just disconnect the turbo boost line. And the fueling seems to pretty much sort itself out. Now I got a sort of ongoing experiment with these because I had a vehicle. It's a very long story, which I won't bore you with now. But it was a 200 TEI, which had one of these boost rings on it, just timing advanced spacers.
Yeah,
which for various reasons was removed from that, and I was left with this little piece of aluminium sitting around doing nothing. And I was thinking a 200 TEI is designed, the advance curve on that is designed around it having a turbo.
Right.
And so they will limit the advance so you don't keep cylinder temperatures and pressures down. Now, without a turbo, you don't need to worry so much about that. So actually changing the advance curve so you get a bit more timing advance high speeds. Because one thing I did notice with the 200 TEI is that although it cools extraordinarily well from low speeds, really good torque, it tend to run out of pup higher up. There's no point revving them beyond a certain point because they just don't pull any harder.
Okay.
And so I thought I'd try fitting this timing spacer to a 200 DI conversion I was doing time. And it seemed to work really well, but I didn't have the vehicle in the workshop long enough to be able to, you know, put it to daily use. But it did seem to make a difference. And actually, I've just bought a Series 3 short gear base with the 200 DI on it, and I'm going to try fitting one of these spacing rings onto that as well, and I can do it. Then I can get a good feel for whether that actually makes a difference or not.
I was going to say, we were having a little look around your new acquisition, and you would have seen a picture of the truck cab from it, certainly in a recent issue of LRM. Seems like quite a nice vehicle.
Yeah, it's not too bad. It's the sort of thing that a few years ago you could pay about £1,000 for because it needed a rear cross mendlands and holes in the chassis generally, and McGregs had seized. And even now I had a chance to drive that the gearbox isn't brilliant. It works, but it's noisy.
Right.
But as it happens, it's got the 200 DI, it's got parabolic springs, it's got a slightly noisy overdrive on it. It's not a bad spec. It was £3,000. And by modern standards, that's not a bad price, really.
Not at all. I was going to say,
yeah, a little vehicle than that.
A total project with the chassis and bulkhead completely gone is $1,500 these days.
Yeah, and they have got ridiculously expensive. It's one of the reasons why you don't find
many serious vehicles being broken for spares anymore. There were a lot more as projects than there are in bits.
Absolutely. If we just go back quickly to this customer vehicle here, they've chosen some quite, I think, over the time upgrades, they've chosen to modernise it in certain areas, haven't they? What would you say, if you're buying a series and you want to use it as they should be used, but obviously you want it to keep up with modern traffic and behave slightly less terribly on the road, what would you go for?
First thing is not to have a 2¼ diesel, because they really are too slow. Come on, people think, oh, the diesel much better than the petrol, it's more economical, but they're not actually much more economical than the petrol, and they're incredibly slow. So engine-wise, I would say either a 2¼ petrol, a 2½ petrol. They're quite rare, but that works really well in a series vehicle. The old 2.5 turbo diesel from the 19J turbo diesel from the 19110 didn't have a great reputation. But put one in a series vehicle where it's not got so much weight to drag around, they work really nicely. And then you've got 200 TDI in either non-turbo or turbo form, something like that. Gearboxes are tricky on series vehicles because that series four-speed gearbox dates back to 1937. I think it was originally used and developed the Rover 14 slim car. It's really, really short by modern standards. Any other gearbox you put in for whatever is going to be a lot longer, and then you run out of space at the front because the engine clouts the front axle.
Right.
Or you run out of space at the back, where on a short wheelbase vehicle you end up with a crop shaft that's about 6 inches long. And people have done it. People have put LT77 gearboxes into a series vehicle, but it's difficult. So you tend to end up stuck with the four-speed box, which is actually really too low geared for modern use.
So you're looking at either an overdrive or an Ashcroft transfer box, high ratio transfer box, or a set of high ratio differentials if you're on a budget, 3.54 dips from a Defender or Range Rover Classic. And all of those have got advantages and disadvantages, but they will make, any of those will make the vehicle a lot more usable. And in this particular vehicle, because guys got a reasonable amount of money spent on it, so it's got a Roma drive, Canadian made overdrive unit. I fitted a few of those for customers. They're really nice. You fit them, and for about the first 3 miles, you think this is horrible because they're really crunchy and notchy, and then the oil circulates properly, and then they start to bed in, and after that, they're lovely, and they don't give them any trouble.
We're proud to partner with Adrian Flux, an insurance broker that specializes in covering all types of Land Rovers, including classic, ex-military, modified, and Q-plated models. Adrian Flux offers a range of optional extras to make the policy your own and can provide cover for off-roading, green laning, agreed value, and build-up cover. Plus, they even offer a discount of up to 15% for Owners Club members. Simply search Adrian Flux Land Rover Insurance for more information or call them directly on 0344 728 0417 for a quote.
I can't say I've heard anything. In fact, we fitted one to the old LRO Series 3, which was a 2.25 petrol, and that was, like you say, a bit noisy to begin with, and I wondered if something was wrong, but the chap, Ray, who owns the company, is very, very helpful, and like you say, after a little while, it did become more easier to select and a lot quieter. That was a really nice bit of kit. They've also gone for disc brakes on this, haven't they?
Yeah, this has got this disc brake conversion on the front. I've done a couple of those. I mean, the drum brakes on the Series vehicle, even the 10-inch drums, compared to a car of similar period, of similar kind of weight, they're absolutely massive. They're hugely overspecified. But they require a fair bit of maintenance to keep them working properly. You know, every service, you need to take the drums off, clean the shoes, adjust everything. On a vehicle that's not used regularly, the wheel cylinders tend to seize. There's some of the wheel cylinders aren't terribly good quality, and if they leak fluid onto the shoes, then they contaminate the shoes, and then you're looking and you say, how about to change the brake shoes as well as the cylinder? So you can see as a low maintenance option, disc brakes make a lot of sense. I mean, I think they only really make sense on the front. You don't want a lot of braking effort on the rear axle on one of these, especially when it's lightly laden, because it's just going to lock up the back wheels. So this one's still got the standard 10-inch drums on the back. But it's got the Zeus disc brake conversion on the front. That's a nice kit, actually. They were really easy to fit.
I was going to say, I didn't know Zeus was still available.
Yeah, I think they went out of production for a while. I don't know whether the company ran into trouble or what, but they're back now, certainly.
Oh, brilliant.
These we delivered a couple of weeks ago, so as of 2 weeks ago, they were still...
Good to know.
Brake kits. But yeah, it's a really, really nice, easy bolt-on kit. That the hardest part is having to press and stud out all out of the front hubs.
Okay.
And then press new ones in, which really ideally you need a press. When having a press makes it easier, you could probably do it with big hammers. Right. It's easy. It's nicer to do the press.
Yeah, definitely.
And apart from that, it's just straightforward bolt-on stuff.
Wow. Cool.
I'm very impressed with them. You've then got to think about what you're going to do for a brake master cylinder. Disc brakes, you really need they don't have a what they call self-servo action, which drum brakes have, where the reading shoe, or as you apply it, tends to try and dig itself into the brake drum and increases the braking effort on its own. You don't have that disc brakes, so I'm going to have to sort out some kind of brake servo arrangement for it, and then. There isn't a specification for a master cylinder for this setup, so I'll just have to guess.
Well, Richard.
And if I guess wrong, then I'll have to just try another master cylinder until I get the right diameter one.
I can tell you from experience that a 109 servo brake twin circuit cylinder does a fine job.
Right, that's what I was going to try first, so that's good news.
Because I've got the design development engineering discs on the front and LOF, his kit, just the standard, drums on the back, and I put a fresh master cylinder on that servo assisted, and it's pretty good.
Yeah, the biggest problem I've got with that actually now is going to be finding a Series 3 servo pedal box and servo unit.
Okay, because no one's breaking them.
No, no one's breaking them. They've got really, really hard to find. Again, it's one of those bits that you used to be able to pick up out of the city anywhere, but now I'm going to have to turn around one.
I'll keep an eye out for you at spares day, but I suspect this will be done and out the door by then.
I hope so. If it isn't, I'll be in trouble.
it's so good to, obviously, through years of reading LRN, even before I was lucky enough to get a job on the mag, reading your columns has been absolutely brilliant. And when you say you go off and find a part from the shelves that you'd forgotten you had, or, you know, you thought you might have one somewhere, so you sort of go and have a rummage. It really is like that. You have got stacks of bits everywhere.
Yeah, putting together a set of bits for your 2.5 turbo diesel, and I'm trying to find an injection pump that isn't seized solid, you know. Pull one out of the shelf, try turning the shaft. No, that one's seized. For some reason, they seem a bit prone to that. They bumps a few even standing. So I'll try another one. No, that one's seized. Well, how about this wheel for you looking thing? Oh, that turns fine. Well, yeah, you can have that one. I bought far too many bits, really. I am a terrible boarder. I find it very hard to get rid of stuff. And even if I do, I mean, I had this ridiculous thing a couple of days ago where I had a vehicle in for MOT. And I'd just thrown a load of stuff in the scrap, so I thought I wouldn't need it. And it was a vehicle in for service and MOT, and I found two problems with it. One, it was a 200 TDR. One was that the lift pump had failed. It broke in the arm off the lift pump, which they do occasionally.
I've never seen that.
I didn't know about it. It was running fine, as they usually do on a flat surface. I didn't know anything about it until I was draining the oil, and it was a kind of sound of something metallic dropping, falling out of the oil drain hole and dropping into the used oil. And I fished it out, and it was the end of the lift pump. And I didn't have a new one on the shelf. But I'd just thrown away a second-hand one, an old one that I'd found in a box of stuff, because I thought, well, I'm not going to need that. So I fished it out of the scrap bin, cleaned it up, and it works fine. I pictured it, it worked fine. And the other thing was it came back with an MOT advisory for a split track rod boot. Yeah, I've got new track rod ends. Track rod end's fine. It's just the rubber boot is split. What about that track rod end that I've just taken off of Series 3 and throwing the scrap bin? Oh, that's got a perfect boot on it. So, you know, even when I try and throw stuff away, I end up pulling it out of the bin to use it. It's ridiculous, really.
It's that is recycling, reusing to the extreme.
But the result is you end up with huge amounts of stuff. I mean, the modern way to run a garage is people say to you, oh, you don't want to hold any stock. That's just dead money tied up. You can order everything on a van. Not if you're working on old Land Rovers, you can't.
No, I was going
to
say,
every time you have to order something in on a van, you held up on the job. So you do have to carry quite a lot of stock, new and used parts. And I've got a lot of stuff here because just so that I don't draw into a halt on what should be an ordinary routine job. And have to wait a day for bits to be toured.
It was interesting you said earlier about there was a sort of a dip where it was very difficult to get certain parts, but you feel like the supply of stuff for the older vehicles is actually getting better.
Yeah, that's the impression I get, certainly for some of the more obscure series bits. There was a point where, yes, there was stuff starting.
It was starting to look a bit worrying in terms of even routine service replacement stuff was starting to get difficult to get hold of. And then we had COVID come along, and that did a lot of damage to supply chains, and manufacturers were sourcing stuff from wherever they could get it. And some of the stuff that was being sold then was really, really utter rubbish and unfit for any purpose. But that's what pretty much worked its way through now. And I've noticed that there are more parts being remanufactured, particularly for series vehicles, some of the small stuff, little brackets and things that previously you would have got one off a scrap vehicle because they were unavailable from Land Rover and anyone else could pop to make them. And now you find that actually you can buy one. I needed a bracket for a brake pipe bracket for this, for the vehicle, this Series 2A that I'm working on at the moment. It's got Series 3 type brake pipe arrangement on it. And I thought I'd got some in a box, but I couldn't find them anywhere. And I thought, no way am I going to be able to find one of those on the internet. So I got on the internet and find that, yeah, you can buy them brand new for £11. That's something keeps happening. And the other thing I've noticed is there seems to be a move slow. I don't know quite how big it is, but there seems to be a steady move back towards sourcing stuff in the UK again. away from China and India, and I'm starting to see more British-made components for all the Land Rovers turning up in here, particularly electrical components.
Okay.
There's stuff like the park switches, which are one of those bits that always fail on either a Series or a Defender.
You can now buy those. You can still buy the overseas made ones, or you can buy one that says, proudly says, made in Britain now, and we will probably last about as long as the originals did, which is not very long actually.
They were rubbish. Those are one of the most underspecified, horrible pieces of switch gear ever to fit into a vehicle.
I can't say I've ever had...
Along with Series brake light switches.
That's what I was literally about to say. Brake light switches are just... They're like consumable items. I always carry a spare.
The trick with those actually is to wind through a relay, so they're only carrying relay switching loads and then they last forever.
Interesting. Okay.
But no one ever bothers to do that.
I was going to say...
Because it's easier to fit a new switch because they're only about £3. But they are... Yeah. They don't like carrying that kind of load.
No.
They were never good enough when they were new.
A faint whiff of burning followed by no brake lights through the bulkhead is an all too common occurrence, I'm sure, for many Series and early Defender or 11090 owners. But what did make me smile recently in one of your columns was you spoke about your utter disdain for working on a TB5.
Oh, that's a bit harsh. I've never had a lot to do with them. I took a decision a long time ago. You have to have it. If you're going to do old vehicles, you've got to have a cutoff date at some point. And I decided that mine would be 1997 last of the TDIs.
Right.
And I wasn't really... And the only reason for that really is if you're going to do TD5s, there's a certain number of special tools you need. You need the diagnostic equipment, plug-in diagnostics for it. And also you need to start building up that experience of them, because a TD5 engine is a funny old thing. And they have their own quirks, and if you don't know your way around the engines, then you're back into that steep learning curve thing. I'm always astonished by the kind of general garages, the sort of village garages who will tackle any make of car, any model of car, because every single job must be a learning curve.
Sure.
Yeah, there's so just about every job that comes in will be something they haven't seen before. I don't know how they manage it, really.
I completely agree. Certainly ones that, like you say, your general garages where they're working on a different make and model every day. Yeah. You think, even if you're not going into the intricacies, and even if you are just ordering and replacing parts, it must take a lot longer to actually learn your way around each thing and actually make money on it. Because, everything must be fresh and new.
Yeah.
And when you, I think it highlights the value of when you do find a good independent Land Rover specialist that you know and trust and will do the job properly, hold on to them, because, you know, it turns something that can be quite cost effective and, you know, the work's been done to a good standard to a complete unknown, really, if you go to, you know, any general thread in the shed, to coin a phrase. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, but going back to TD5s, you can see the start of the process of trying to simplify and, trying to cheapen the things and make them easier to manufacture at the expense of making them harder to work on.
Right.
And some of the accessibility stuff on TD5s is pretty poor. Oil filter, that canister oil. Wait, behind the exhaust downpipe, right up against I can't remember which casting it is.
I think it's the big oil filter housing, isn't it?
Just about impossible to get up unless you have a specific special tool. Now, as far as I'm concerned, if you've got a vehicle that needs special tools to do an oil change, this isn't really, it's not really in the traditional spirit of Land Rover. And it's only got worse since then.
Yes, I agree with you. I think... I do kind of see why it's been done, because they've got more and more emission stuff to, you know, the whole engine is encased in gubbins and, you know, it's in the same size shell or a similar size shell. And yeah, it must be a challenge, but the actual, especially, you know, high turnover, not consumables, but things that fail often, you'd think would make more sense to have half accessible.
Yeah.
And that certainly isn't the case on anything probably... 2008 onwards.
Yeah, something like Discovery 4, Range Rovers 4. It's like, my screen wash pumps failed. Body off. That's quite that bad, but it's amazing the number of jobs on those that where you actually have to lift the body. And it turns out not to be a problem if you're a biggish Land Rover specialist. You just get the lifting gear in, and by the time you've done three or four of them, you've probably got the routine down very nicely, and you'll end up lifting body for jobs that you wouldn't necessarily need to, just because it's easier.
Yes, definitely. That's certainly the case now, because, like you say, specialists who are doing them day in, day out, they can have a body off in a couple of hours.
Yeah.
One thing that has struck me about your workshop, and please don't take this the wrong way, is you don't have any a four or a two post lift.
No, I didn't really have the space for it, to be honest.
Okay.
That's always been the problem with this workshop. I'd looked at it, and I've actually been offered a couple of four post lifts, nice ones, quite cheaply. And then I've sort of measured everything up, and I've realized that turns the workshop from a four vehicle workshop to a two vehicle workshop.
Right.
And so I've always managed with that. It's one of the reasons I've run into so many injury problems is many years of working with, frankly, inadequate facilities and crawling around on concrete floors underneath vehicles instead of having a nice lift where you can just lift everything up into the air. And that's, again, if anyone out there listening to this is thinking of starting a small Land Rover repair business, get a four post lift.
You'll thank me in about 20 years' time.
It's not easy. It's not easy on the body, is it?
No.
Any type of physical work. But you can, like you say, but that's one reason we're hot on promoting the use of PPE and proper health and safety practices in the mag is because these things add up and eventually you might pay. But it's one of those, isn't it? Everyone cuts corners where they shouldn't.
I mean, I never used to wear gloves. So I used to, when I was working on all of this stuff, I just get absolutely rained with oil absolutely everywhere. And then I realized actually that is something that is going to catch up with you sooner or later.
Right.
All sorts of nasty things that you're dealing with in your used engine oil, you really don't want penetrating the skip. Even though gloves are actually quite expensive, decent quality ones.
They are.
I've just bought another 5 boxes of them. Yeah. And I wouldn't not use them now.
No.
Occasionally I forget, or I think, oh, there's this job that just involves undoing one screw. I don't need chrome gloves on that. And then I end up with my hands past a black pill. Like when I was digging out those parts for you.
Yeah.
I was pulling out turbos and injection parts, and I thought, I should put some gloves on.
Yeah, and then you're up to your elbows in grime.
I'm not black pill with your hands.
Old diesel engines, they certainly get dirty, don't they?
They do. Yeah, I'm told it is the Land Rover's consistent inability to make things that keep doing where they should be.
I mean, you're very much, the older stuff is very much a product of British industry at the time, and oil leaks weren't considered to be a major issue, whether it was on cars or motorcycles or industrial machinery or whatever.
Mm. It wasn't a big deal if they used a bit of oil up. And so it's really hard to keep them oil tight by it and do.
Again, that's something that more modern materials and methods and things are sort of helping out with. I know HNJ Engineering, I don't know if you ever use their parts, but they're using, I can't remember the exact name of it, but it's a modern gasket material to remake old gaskets. And right. I've used it on my rear plate on the transfer box and the sump plate, and it really has helped slow that. Don't get me wrong, it still leaks, but...
Yeah.
It's leaking from the selector shaft seals on the gearbox now. I need to get around to doing them. But that's helped hugely. But also, like you find with tin or like steel sumps and things like that, the number of times they've been on and off, they get all misshapen and they don't seal properly. And you just constantly find different things.
Yeah, that's it. You can't, you can't assume. You it's very easy to get into a situation where you just think, oh, I'll take that off, put a new gasket, and then it won't leak anymore. Whereas if you stop and look closely at it, you'll find the gasket isn't the only problem you've got.
Yes, definitely.
The actual cover or whatever is bent.
It was funny you mentioned actually the flywheel housing that came off the engine I've bought from you. You said the original that was on it, but
yeah, that was bowed in the middle. It had there's on those two fired diesels. There's two different types of flywheel housing, and my guess is that Land Rover changed the design for a reason. These I found that the thing had a distinct dip in it at the bottom, directly underneath the crankshaft seal housing, which meant RCV sealant has a certain amount of gap filling capability, but it's ideally, you don't want big gaps in it, and this one had a fairly, you put a straight edge across it and see a fair amount of daylight through it. And so I pulled out another flywheel housing from my big pile of flywheel housings, and that one was exactly the same. And I pulled out a third one in the same design,
And that one is exactly.
And then I got one of the later posts, or post 1989 pattern runs, which are directly interchangeable with the early ones, and that one was fine. Conclusion, Land Rover changed the design for a reason.
To make them not banana-shaped.
So they must have had a problem with them being distorting a bit when they're pulled up tight.
Fantastic. Yeah, like you say, oil leaks, people put up with them, but the fewer you can have, the better, really. Moving on then, obviously you see all manner of different Land Rovers through your doors, I'm sure, or yeah, the time you've been going. Are there any things that really wind you up where someone's had a go at something or a previous garage has been in and you think, why have you done that?
Electrics.
Okay.
Yeah. People do really bizarre things with electrics and, yeah, anything. I mean, one of those things I hate is I have a vehicle will come in and it's got a few accessories of various kinds on it. And I need to disconnect the battery, possibly to do some welding or something like that. And I take the lid off the battery box under the passenger seat, and I'm confronted with this absolute horror show of random wiring and dangling auxiliary fuse boxes and relays sort of floating about in there. And it's just, there's no way that you're going to be able to do any sensible fault finding on this. This is the problem with it. This, if you've got a load of aftermarket wiring of non-standard colours and something goes wrong, then tracing the fault becomes a lot harder. I had one vehicle in fact, it's that white thing's down the yard at the moment. That had a homemade wiring loom in it when it came in. And someone done a really neat job, and they taped up everything neatly and, you know, to crimped all the connectors on properly. The only problem was they'd made the entire thing with red insulated wire. Every single wire in the wiring loom was red.
Wow.
They'd obviously just bought a giant reel with their wire and done every single cable with the same stuff. Which meant you got absolutely zero chance of tracing faults in it. So that went in the bin, and I had a good secondhand wiring loom, a Series 3 wiring loom, which I put in it, which at least has sensible color coding. And can actually work out what's going on. I actually managed to get all the lights working.
I had a sale on red wire at the time.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Crikey.
But I've seen that this a few times before, people using it.
Kids with strange wiring arrangements. I've had a few vehicles actually that come in to reasonably major work, and you pull the dashboard out, and there's just this mass of aftermarket wiring and Scotch locks and stuff. And my usual approach, and half the electric stemware, my usual approach to those actually now is just to pull out everything that wasn't put there by Land Rover.
Yeah,
and then see what still works. And go from there.
I completely agree. I've bought vehicles in the past. I put a picture up on my Instagram years ago I had a 110 station wagon. It had this horrible faux carbon fiber center console with a few switches in it. I pulled it forward and there must have been 50 Scotch locks in there. It was absolutely hideous. And the first thing I did was rip everything out, put it in the bin, and then start fresh, because you can tell what should be there and what shouldn't. But wiring is one of those things. It doesn't take much for you to go from having a Land Rover to not having a Land Rover anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah. The wiring fires. One of the problems with these vehicles, even in standard forms, and particularly on the older ones, is Land Rover weren't that keen on using fuses.
No, they seem to have a real aversion to fuses.
And right up till, certainly till the, you know, till the end of Series 3 production, there were far too many circuits on those that draw a fair amount of power and are completely unfused. Headlights, side lights, horn. Yeah, there's quite a lot of stuff there that there's a lot of potential for things to go badly wrong.
Headlights, again, you mentioned there, putting a relay on the brake light switch. The headlights instantly become fantastic if you actually fit a relay to them.
You put a changeover relay on the headlight switch as well. I've done that a couple of times with the floor-mounted dip switches on Series 2As, which seem to give a certain amount of trouble.
Okay.
That's one that works a lot better if you put it through a relay. Land Rover were a bit averse to relays. I mean, maybe that's just a standard thing for British motor industry in the 60s and 70s. That I don't know whether Morris Marinas are short of relays as well, but
I suspect
Land Rover really didn't use relays unless they were absolutely forced to at gunpoint.
Yeah, relays are probably expensive, that's why.
Yeah.
But yeah, why fit a relay when you can just change a switch five times a year?
Well, yes. That's basically the attitude.
I would say you mentioned a little bit earlier on your website. Will your website still be live when you move?
Yeah, I keep meaning to sort of do something because it was done about 20 years ago, and I don't think it works very well on mobile phones.
And I actually got as far as having a new website designed for me, and then decided to go on this change of direction for the business. So a lot of the website would now be obsolete, so it's never gone live. But at some point, I've got to move it onto a more modern platform. But the information will still be there.
That's fantastic to hear. I was a bit worried you were going to say no, because if you think Richard's columns in the MAG are insightful, head to, is it glencoinengineering.co.uk?
glencoin.co.uk.
It is an absolute treasure trove of really, really useful information. I've always got a tab open on my computer because if I need to know something, the man's been there, he's done it, he's seen it probably, you know, more times than most people have had hot dinners. It really is fantastic resource. So thanks.
That's very kind of you to say so. I mean, some of the, you'll be a little bit wary that just bear in mind that some of that stuff was written in the early 2000s. Anything involving vehicle, any information on there involving vehicle values or the price for which you can pick up a 200 GBI is thoroughly out of date.
Which is unfortunate because everyone would love
I need to go through it and modernize it a little bit.
A 2000s price 200 TDI would be lovely. But
those engines, at one point, I bought five of them from a scrapyard. They were on the floor. I paid £150 each for. Brought them all back to the workshop, put them on my test bed, and one of them needed a water pump, one of them needed the head gasket, and the other three were just ran absolutely fine, good oil pressure, sweet as anything. They just went straight into bits and straight out. I wish I could do that now.
Yeah, definitely. Sign of the times, isn't it? The same situation applies to vehicles themselves. But we'll touch on your test bed quickly, actually. You've got a very handy looking, it's a sort of rack on wheels, which you can bolt TDIs and other engines into, and it lets you run them up so you can test them.
Yeah, it started out as it's one of those military transit frames that occasionally you turn up, which were used by the army for storing and moving around 2.5 NA engines. And I've strapped that to a wheels trolley, which I suspect originally belonged to, it looks like some kind of industrial trolley for moving stuff around. And I can bolt an engine to any of the four-cylinder engines from over to a liquid petrol up to a 300 TDI. And then just plumb it in. And it's fairly simple to getting up the electrics and fuel the coolant to actually get an engine running. And that means I can pull, if I've got an engine that I don't know, either I don't know its history or it's one that I've just rebuilt, particularly if it's one that I've rebuilt and I'm going to be sending out on a pallet, I can put it on the test stand, run it up and see if any, and make sure that it's got good oil pressure, make sure it doesn't leak coolant, doesn't leak oil. And then I'm confident that engine can be put into a vehicle and you can just turn the key and go.
You know your 4x4. You've chosen every upgrade, every bolt-on with purpose. So when it comes to tyres, chunkier, wider, more capable for the conditions, you want the perfect fit. Not just any tyre, your tyre. That's why you'll choose 4x4tyres.co.uk, the wheel and tyre specialists. Trusted by Land Rover owners and serious off-roaders alike. Whether you're upsizing, overlanding, making your Defender look the part, or your Discovery turn heads, we'll guide you to the right set. With over 800 fitting locations across the UK, from online to on-road, we've got you covered. Browse by vehicle, wheel size or brand. 4x4tyres.co.uk. The right fit, the right place, the right price.
The one that's on the test stand at the moment here, which we were talking about earlier, it's a 200 TDI 11 and an 11L Defender 200 TDI that I picked up as a non-runner due to fuel injection pump problems. And I did a certain amount of work on it. It's not had a full rebuild or anything like it. Put it on the test stand yesterday, filled up with coolant, started it up, and then I noticed there's a slight weep from the rear core plug, one that's just above flywheel housing, which turned out to have rusted through.
Right.
Now, if I were to put that into a vehicle and then started it out, I would now be looking at taking it out again. It's that core plug. Is the only way you're going to change that core plug is to take the engine out.
huge time saver.
So, you know, it takes me about 30 minutes to get an engine bolted to the stand, plumbed up and running, but it saved me a lot of hassle doing it that way.
Right, and another thing I was admiring earlier is the custom-made bar you've got for lifting these four-cylinder engines that keeps the engine crane hooked nice and close to the engine, so you've got more control and you can lift it into things like the back of a 109.
Yeah, that was just, I got fed up with fiddling around with chains. If you lift enough engines with a chain, eventually the links of the chain start to bend, and you can't get the shackle pins through them. And one day I was struggling with this length of chain, and I thought there must be a better way. So I just draw a piece of angle iron, cut it up, welded it all together, and drilled a hole in it. And suddenly I got a custom made engine lifting bar, which if you were to buy, there's probably one in the Churchill Tools catalog. It'll have a Land Rover special part number, and it'll be about £250.
Yeah, it's these things you learn from doing, don't you? Going back to the website quickly, and to an extent, the magazine, or certainly the magazine, information. There's information out there which can be trusted, and there's information that shouldn't. And you've got an interesting. We spoke a little bit about AI.
About AI and the way that's going. And there's been what I've noticed very recently, certainly over the last year on the internet, is an increasing amount of AI generated content. And it's getting to the stage where people are now using AI, setting AI the task of generating its own content. Most of this stuff isn't special. I did a few tests on it using these AI sort of chatbot things to ask various technical questions. I wasn't entirely impressed by the reliability of the information, and I think that's only going to get worse. People are trying to monetize it. They're trying to use AI to create content so they can then get likes and shares for, and then get a share of the advertising revenue. And no one's paying too much attention to how reliable the information is. And I think possibly within 5 years' time, the internet is going to be so badly gluted by AI generated bad information that the only reliable source of information is going to be from books that were published before AI was invented.
Yes.
So do not throw away your workshop manuals.
Or your copies of LRN.
Or basically anything, any printing you do. I've got loads of books, reference books on various subjects. I've decided, I'm not going to throw them out because at some point they're actually going to be useful.
Yeah.
They're going to be the only way to get reliable information.
The shows, Land Rover events, spares days, they're fantastic places to pick up genuine like workshop manuals, parts manuals, things like that. And that information is, I mean, obviously part numbers get superseded, things like that. But generally speaking, that information is straight from the horse's mouth. It hasn't been messed with by any artificial intelligence, and you can trust it.
And so parts books, if you've got an old Land Rover, if you're only going to buy one thing, buy a genuine Land Rover parts catalog. It's got beautiful exploded diagrams, very nicely drawn with very few mistakes, and there are a couple, but they're very few, which give you the part numbers, but also show how everything goes together, and they show you the correct length and bolt to go in each position and everything else. Really, really very valuable. In terms of the actual workshop manuals, it's probably going to be a bit heretical here, but actually for most people, I would recommend a Haynes manual over the official Land Rover workshop manual, just because the Haynes manuals, they set things out in a more logical order. Most of their stuff is just copied and pasted from the Land Rover official workshop manual anyway. It's
right.
It's very obvious, certainly for the older ones. It's very obvious when you look at the drawings where they got the information from.
Okay.
Obviously with Land Rover's permission. But they're just laid out in a more user-friendly format. Unfortunately, Haynes themselves seem to have gradually moved away from that. The Haynes Series 2A3 workshop manual actually tells you how to rebuild a series gearbox in some detail.
Wow.
Whereas for more modern cars, they'll just say, this is our side scope and this manual contact will tier.
Right. I suppose,
for the older stuff, I've got a pile of Haynes manuals, and I will usually refer to those before the main battery workshop manual for ordinary routine stuff like torque wrench setting, just because it's easier to find the information in there.
Fair enough. That's interesting, and it's good to know that. I think there's that level of people go by the Bible of the, you know, because it's got Land Rover logo on it, but sometimes
you know, information does get a bit Chinese whisper syndrome as it goes to different places, especially the internet. But knowing that Haynes can be trusted as well, brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I refer to it as the AIDS book of comforting lies, but it's probably a bit unfair.
Refitting is the reverse of removal, which
it isn't.
You'll have to fight far harder to get it back on. But
yeah, absolutely.
Haynes, I think everyone, most Land Rover people will have at least one Haynes manual kicking about. I can think of probably three that I've got at home. Yeah, they are. They're good. And of course, the tech section of LRM, which we try and be as accurate as possible and, you know, impart such knowledge that won't fade into the ether like it might do if you bash something into Google and then rely on the first AI suggestion that comes up.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't do that.
And there is a certain amount of... I don't think it's yet too much actually dangerous misinformation out there, but there's also stuff that is a bit misleading.
Mm. Yeah. I just think the lack of effort is what gets to me most, especially like I've moaned to Steve about before. You go on eBay and you see a listing and you think, oh, that looks quite tempting. You click on it and there's absolutely nothing about the vehicle or the part that's for sale. It's just AI drivel about the history of whatever model it happened to be.
Yeah, that seems to be getting more and more common. That'll put the odds straight away.
Yeah, it does me. I just think
I'm just not going to be interested if it's an AI generated description. It's not going to tell me anything useful about what I'm looking at.
It's not, it doesn't know, that's the thing. It's just rehashing, recycling information. And as you know, rightly said earlier, eventually AI will be feeding AI.
Yeah, yeah.
And then before you know it, nothing's
trustworthy anymore.
No, which is a real, you know, quite
it's
scary.
The internet has been a game changer in terms of being able to work on these vehicles as a small business. Yeah, there's stuff that I can I come up with problems. For instance, I had a Land Rover Series 3 lightweighting, 24 volt electrics, not charging. Now that system, apart from the fact there seem to be several different versions of it, it's not something that I've got any technical information to hand. I don't have a wiring diagram for a 24 volt lightweight, but the internet does.
Yeah.
So I just went on, typed into Google, and within about a minute, I'd got sitting, coming off my printer, a complete wiring diagram for a 24-volt lightweight. Now, pre-internet, you couldn't do that.
No.
You would have struggled to get that information. So it is very useful, but again, that what you're doing there, obviously, is just accessing a digitized version of a
exactly
AI printed document.
Yes.
And there's a difference between that and actually looking at stuff that's entirely AI generated,
relying on some utter bunkum that the computer somewhere has come up with. Like you say,
it means of accessing human generated information. It's fine, but you've got to be. I think we'll have to be increasingly careful about verifying the sources.
Definitely,
before we start relying on it.
It's not. It sounds like we're being awfully old fashioned, and you know, the internet, like you say, is a huge resource, but you have to be careful about how it's used. That's all we're saying.
Yeah.
And bear that in mind, of course. But yeah, it's finally to it's great to finally be here and have a look around on in awe of the place and the amount of I know you said it yourself, the sheer amount of stuff that you've got is just mind blowing. How you know where everything is?
I don't know. That's again, it's back to the side of how do you know so? Well, I just know. I know what's roughly on the shelves, and it's like I know I've got one of those somewhere. Or sometimes the system lets me down and I can't find the things I was sure I had on the shelf. It would actually have been quicker just to order one.
Where's the fun in that?
Then I got stuff that you just can't buy new or not at a sensible price. And that stuff I'll be holding on to whatever happens.
Just quickly, before we wrap up, because we are almost at an hour, would you believe? Your engine mounts. You've got engine mounts. Tell me about them.
That was a funny thing, because I was the it started the bear, dear old Bearback, who unfortunately had gone along with us, did they did an engine mount for Defenders that was they did two versions. They did their standard engine mount, and then they did a what they called an OEM engine mount, suffix GAR1808G, which they were sourcing, I think, from Avon Rubber, from what I can gather.
Right.
So they were, and those were really nice. I discovered, because I had problems with one quite early on with excessive engine vibrations on an engine I fitted, and I tried these
high quality mounts, and they were absolutely beautiful and not with vibration on the head. And after that, I carried on using these mounts until the day where I came to order some more from Bearmac and discovered they'd been discontinued, which gave me a real problem because I tried half a dozen other different brands of engine mounts and they were all as hard as rock.
Right.
Cheap for a reason.
Sure.
No one was doing a good quality engine mount. Anyway, I got one single orphan Bearmac engine mount left, and I had a hunt round a few companies until I found one that actually specialised in industrial rubber products, and I got in touch with them, and I basically sent them their engine mount and said, can you copy this in terms of specification?
Yeah.
And they put it on their vibration tester and measured it, and then they came up with one that was of identical specification, and they sent me the graph, and it was the way it was performed in terms of vibrations, absolutely identical. And so I ordered 100 of them, sold them quite quickly, and then ordered another 100. I've probably done about, God knows, probably about 2,000 or 3,000 by now.
Wow,
it's ridiculous that I, one of the smallest Land Rover businesses in the country, it now appears to be the only place in the world that you can buy good quality engine mounts from.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous. But that's just where I am. I mean, they're a lot more expensive. Yeah, you can buy your stand bench mounts for about, you can get them for about £3 or £4 each, mine are £25 a pair.
Yeah.
But when you fit them, you know where that money's gone.
100%. I've got them on them.
Yeah.
On the engine and gearbox on my Series 3. Series 3. And I was.
They do make a massive difference.
I was going to say, it's not quite so bad with the V8 anyway, because it's a bit smoother. But on a 4-cylinder diesel, I bet you cut it down enormously. People can buy them from your eBay shop?
Yeah, from the eBay shop, yes.
Which is just Glencoin
Engineering.
Right, got you. So if you need engine mounts, Pedo, I would wholeheartedly recommend spending that bit extra because it'll pay off down the line when you don't have to jack your engine up and change them again because you've got a headache every time you drive. But I think that's pretty much it. I think we'll call it there if you're happy to. You got anything else to say, Richard?
No, I think that's covered quite a lot of ground, really. It's been fun.
Good to have a chat. Good to have a chat. Yeah. Well, thanks as always for listening. Don't forget, if you've got time, if you'd like to, leave us a little rating or a review on your preferred streaming platform. Follow Land Rover Monthly on social media, on, of course, Instagram and Facebook. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. If you want to follow mine and Steve's personal accounts on Instagram, I'm Land Rover Martin. He is Steve Miller Automotive. And yeah, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed the episode, and we'll catch you next week.